Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting live and video streaming from our studios in New York City, and I welcome all of you from all over the world. It's always nice to know that people are making healthy choices in Ireland and Scotland and in Japan, China. Every day we get emails from around the world. Today, we're going to talk about the latest on health and healing, and all the information that is shared here each day comes from peer review science. For example, today, magnesium can help reduce colon cancer, and vitamin D can prevent bladder cancer. And 7 days a week of happiness and mental well-being, a new study on that, and a new link between a high-fat Western diet and atherosclerosis identified. Now, all these are from mainstream institutions. Why do I emphasize that? Why, with every single program, every day of the year, year in and year out, do I take the time to give you the journal, the place where the study originated? Because we've been led to believe in an intentional media campaign that the diet doesn't really matter. Just eat everything in moderation. And that there is no functional ability of food to make any difference in your life. It's just protein, fats, carbohydrates. And as long as you don't eat too much, everything's fine. And vitamins, you don't need them. The superfoods, there's nothing super about them. And if there was, good science would prove it. All right? That's their argument. Now, mind you, these are the very same institutions that support treating obesity and diabetes and heart disease and cancer and mental conditions in ways that rarely are effective, extremely toxic, and are not based upon sound science. So when there is good science, so that when you do decide to make a change, you can feel confidence that change is grounded in legitimate science. Today also a commentary that is necessary for today's guest. It's not a fiscal cliff. It's a descent into lawlessness. How we have been manipulated. Washington Blob, Global Research, my own insights and commentary I wrote last night. I'm going to share a different perspective about why nothing being done right now with this game about the fiscal cliff is utterly it's indifferent to what's about to happen. And then my guest will follow. My guest is one of our most popular guests. He is Gerald Salante. And once a year, we invite Gerald on to do a end of year, beginning of new year predictions. We're going to look at the major events that we believe are going to be unfolding this coming year. And I'll be asking Gerald about where he sees the economy going, fracking, the bond market, which I believe is a bubble, the very, very aggressive secession progression movement out there where states want to secede, also war, peace, and the next great awakening. So we have a lot to talk about. You won't want to miss that, and I suggest to let people know that we're doing it. Also today, a brief commentary from Thomas Lindsay from the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund on restoring democracy in the fight against fracking and why the corporations have so much power. Thomas wrote a brilliant and insightful piece. It's not long. I'll share it with you. As you see, we have a lot to do. Let's begin. First up, this is not the time of year when most people are outside enough to get enough vitamin D. On a good day, let's say where the weather's in the 60s or 70s, if you had your shirt off or you had shorts on or you were jogging for over a half hour, you get about 20,000 units of vitamin D produced from the sun in your skin, in your body. That would help defend you against cancer, heart disease, dementia, and it also helps turn off inflammation. Here is the latest study from Natural Society. It says a growing body of research links the prevalence of cancer with vitamin D deficiency. We've seen it connected to breast and colon cancer as well as melanoma, the most deadly form of skin cancer. But a new study out of Spain says people who are deficient in what we call the sunshine vitamin, vitamin D, are at higher risk for bladder cancer. This was published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. And it shows that you have a substantial increase in bladder cancer if you're deficient in vitamin D. So my suggestion is, aside from eating a really healthy diet, just take a vitamin D supplement. They're inexpensive and easy to do. Happiness and mental health are highest among people who eat 7 portions of fruits and vegetables a day. But very few people do. I believe we should be eating about 11, but I believe we should be juicing what would amount to about 20. How does that work? Well, you can try this for yourself. Everybody could eat an apple. Now, juice an apple. Take out the core, juice the apple, an organic apple, and you'll get about 2, maybe 3 ounces of juice. Then, see if you could drink the juice from 4 apples. Easy to do. I do it every day. I have a green apple, celery, cucumber, and lemon juice made for each day. That's one of several juices I drink. But it's great for thinning the blood. That helps prevent stroke. It's great for helping the body cleanse and detoxify. It oxygenates the blood and hence the cells. It keeps your red blood cells from congregating. And I am particularly up on juicing prior to going on an airplane because your legs are bent and sometimes because of turbulence, you can't get up when you want and walk around. Ideally, you should get up and stretch about every 30 minutes when on a plane. You should also take extra vitamin E, coenzyme Q10, vitamin C, and tocotrienols. That'll naturally help circulation and thinning of the blood, preventing thrombosis or clot forming in your legs and going up to your heart. Very common thrombosis. So it's not difficult to get your juices and hence get the amount of vegetables you need. They're great. You're not wasting anything. You're just taking the whole food and making the juice, and just the pulp is expelled. You're not getting the fiber from it, but you're getting what really does the healing. So in this study, what they found, and this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Social Indicators Research, that mental well-being rises with the number of daily portions of fruits and vegetables consumed. Researchers in economics and public health, the University of Warwick in UK, studied the eating of 80,000 people in Britain, finding that mental well-being peaked at 7 portions a day. Now, most of the people in the United States think that 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day is great for cardiovascular health and protect against cancer. A yes and no. Yes, I would prefer 5 over none, but no, I believe that's the very bottom end. You should have much more. And also, how was the vegetable prepared? A lot of Americans eat their fruit in cans. Well, those are nutritionally dead. I mean, you look at yes, there was a time when people put up preserves and it was loaded with sugar and you'd cook something nearly to death and you'd put about 12 tablespoons of sugar in a quart jar. But that's what they ate because they didn't have it fresh supplied year-round. Today we do. But that doesn't mean people were eating organic and regular. So fruits throughout a day are good. Vegetables throughout a day are good. And it's going to make you feel better about yourself. Magnesium, according to the Eastern European Journal of Clinical Nutrition, reduces colon cancer. Now, colon cancer is so easily preventable. If we got rid of all meat, and that includes chicken and dairy and wheat, and we've included 10 servings of fruits and vegetables a day along with vitamin C, there's really no reason to develop colorectal cancers when you have congesting foods. foods that slow down digestion and then putrefy in the gut. Now, every time you cook something, you are making what you're cooking much more susceptible to carcinogenic accumulates in the body, what are called heterocyclic amines. As a result, ideally, you should pass a meal the byproducts with bacteria and fibers, and once you have completed a meal, that's the ideal. A lot of people, they're lucky if they pass one meal for every two, so there's always congestion. Some people have 10, 12 pounds of backup matter in their intestine and colon. Now, of course, you take some bentonite in a drink. If you take cabbage juice with some vitamin C, that's going to dislodge and come out of there. So this is simply saying take your magnesium. And here's what it says, quote, on the basis of the findings of this meta-analysis, a higher magnesium intake is associated with reduction in the risk of colorectal cancer. So that's good news. I'm going to suggest 1,000 milligrams of magnesium a day and 1,000 milligrams of calcium a day. And also, from Science Daily, Columbia University Medical Center, published in Atherosclerosis, Thrombosis, and Vascular Biology, a new link between high-fat westernized diet and atherosclerosis. I'll quote this. Researchers have found that a diet high in saturated fat raises the endothelial lipase, an enzyme associated with the development of atherosclerosis, and conversely, that a diet high in the omega-3 polyunsaturated fat lowers this level of enzyme. The findings establish a new link between diet and atherosclerosis and suggest a novel way to prevent cardiovascular heart disease. In addition, the research may help to explain why the type 2 diabetes drugs have been linked to heart problems. So the takeaway message from this study is look at all the programs on television. With rare exception, they promote disease. But people get used to the taste, and then once you have developed a taste, a smell, a mouthfeel, a sense of how you feel, and a lot of people only feel good when they feel full. So portion size is no longer meaningful in the United States, because eat until you're full means, well, eat what the people on television eat, which is supersized meals. And with that, you're getting a week's worth of protein frequently and a week's worth of fat in one meal. And that's one of the reasons we have a nation that is morbidly obese. Finally, vitamin K can slash diabetes risk. And this is only 100 micrograms per day. And this is according to this latest study, slashed diabetes risk substantially. So make sure you're getting your vitamin K. It can help you, and it's good. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Thrombosis and Hemostasis. That's it on health and nutrition. We have a lot to cover. And I want to go to a couple of issues before we take our break. I'm going to give a lot of time to our guest today. This is from Lawrence Davidson from Op-Ed News. And it's entitled On the Killing of Children and Others, Domestic and Foreign, an Analysis. He says, and I'll quote this, here is part of an Associated Press announcement appearing in U.S. papers declaring the time for action overdue. President Obama promised to send to Congress broad proposals for tightening gun laws and curbing violence after last week's schoolhouse massacre in Connecticut. Then it goes on to talk about the issue of violence goes far beyond Newton, Connecticut incident. Of course, and its ubiquity on the streets as well as in the schools is what has moved Obama to finally act. By the way, how have we really acted? And what have we done outside of looking at the guns, the type of guns? We have not yet looked at any of the backgrounds of virtually 100% of the killers, mass murderers in our schools in the last couple years. They've all been on psychiatric meds. That concerns me. Here's what he says. Here in the United States, guns kill about 17,000 people a year. By the way, psychiatric meds kill 3,000 people per month. So you get twice as many people killed by psychiatric medication each month than you do by people using guns. And that is hard enough. But the real picture is actually much worse. The domestic death toll caused by America's civilian propensity to act out moments of power through violence is but a pittance compared to the carnage the U.S. produces through the projection of military and other forms of force abroad. Using guns, mechanized weapons, and chemical agents in Vietnam, the United States demonstrated its power and managed to kill more than 2 million civilians. It is not possible to know how many of these were children, but the number isn't at the tens of thousands. In Iraq, the U.S. developed a new official weapon that has proved particularly fatal to children. This is the weapon of sanctions. Such sanctions demonstrate that the U.S. has the power to manipulate most of the world's economy to the detriment of its enemies. In the case of Iraq, sanctions functioned as a sort of economic Agent Orange. They defoliated the country's societal infrastructure over a 13-year period. Sanctions were imposed in 1990 as a consequence of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait and maintained after the conclusion of the First Gulf War. As a consequence of these sanctions, important medicines, vital repair parts for water purification and sewage systems and other necessary items were not allowed to be imported into Iraq. The death of some, and it was 500,000 children, that's a 500,000 children, mostly under age of five, can be directly or indirectly tied to this sanctions regime. The sanctions were only removed in 2003 when we invaded the country. Then came the weapons-related deaths as a result of the Second Gulf War from 2003 to 2011, launched on false pretenses by the Bush administration, realistic estimates of up to 1 million additional Iraqi deaths as adults and children. And now there are reports that Washington is once more, through the weapon of sanctions, creating the conditions for the deaths of young, vulnerable, and innocent children in Iran. According to Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council, U.S. sanctions are starting to impact the health of innocent Iranian civilians. Iran's ability to purchase some medicines and hospital equipment has been impaired by U.S. sanctions, and people have already died as a result. Nonetheless, American lawmakers such as Robert Mendez, Democrat in New Jersey, have successfully sponsored even more sanctions for Iran. Quote, "It seems to me we have to completely exhaust all the tools in our sanctions arsenal and do so quickly before Iran finds a way to navigate out of its current crisis," end quote. Why are Mendez and his fellows in Congress doing this? Because some alleged Iranian nuclear weapons program? No. The Iranian sanctions, growing slowly in intensity, predate that concern. Since the fall of the Shah of Iran that we sponsored in 1979, Washington has conceived of Iran as an enemy and therefore a legitimate target against which to demonstrate our power. It is reasonable to assume that Menendez knows what such policies mean in human terms. But like former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, referring to the disastrous consequences of the Iraq sanctions, where she said, yeah, it's acceptable that 500,000 children died, he seems to believe that the horror of it is worth it. Many Americans are dismayed, as they surely should be, by the domestic massacre of their children. These are the deaths closest to home and the ones they are forced to face due to the media attention. They are also confused about what to do because, for so many, guns and freedom are synonymous. All the other instances of violence, the nightly murders in the poor districts of cities and towns across the nation, the piled-up bodies of adults and children in places like Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan are largely hidden from the citizenry, and certainly the consequences of the average citizen of Iran, of the U.S. government acting out in a powerful way, will be kept remotely enough so to avoid all empathy. So here then is the question. Why do you believe that as a country we have never once taken responsibility for the death of innocents all those who were not enemy combatants in Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, Panama, Grenada, Iraq, Afghanistan, across the world. The number is in the millions and millions. That's genocide. And yet, no one in the mainstream media will say, how could we be considered exceptional when we cannot be responsible? That is my question. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with commentary and my guest. Please stay with us.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feel, and I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart, and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face. I'll walk down the lane.
I'd like to welcome all of you to this program. I'm Gary Nall. We're video and broadcasting, streaming in New York. Now for a commentary that will lead directly into my guest. My guest is standing by, Gerald Salante. He's up in Rhinebeck, New York. Gerald Salante is one of today's pioneers in what is called trend strategy. He founded the Trends Research Institute in Kingston, New York, and he is the publisher of the Trends Journal and has been since 1980. He is a diagnostician. He is a forecaster. He looks at all the different crises in the world and projects forward to see what is the likely outcome. And he'll be here to give his insight, looking back and looking forward. But first, we are all right now caught up in the idea that somehow the world will end economically if we do not jump right in there and support one side or the other or some compromise on this fiscal cliff. I say it is nonsense. It is irrelevant. It is the dot at the end of a million word document. It is not a tax on or spending problem. It is de-evolving into lawlessness. I say today that the fiscal cliff, as we have been led to believe, is a myth. Instead, what we are facing is a descent into lawlessness. In many situations, austerity programs are imposed on countries that are previously under dictatorial regimes, leading to criticisms that populations are forced to repay the debts of their oppressors. Indeed, the International Monetary Fund has already performed a complete audit of the whole U.S. financial system, something which they have only previously done to broke third world nations. Economist Mark Faber calls the U.S. a failed state. Indeed, we no longer have a free market economy. We have fascism, kleptocracy, oligarchy, or banana republic-style corruption. But do not take my word for it. Let us look into this in detail. As an example, Greece is now cutting back on all of their programs, social programs, food programs, health programs, the minimum wage, their pensions cut in many times 20 to 30%. People are literally dumpster diving, going out at night when they won't be seen by neighbors for embarrassment and humiliation, and looking for anything to eat. Yet they, the citizens of Greece, were not the principal cause of what caused this crisis to begin with. The major bankers like Goldman Sachs, the corrupt generals and the military regime that they had, the deals they made with multinational corporations, including in Germany, buying submarines for billions of dollars. Why would Greece even need a military submarine? Why would they need any military? They didn't. And yet, when the European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund and all those people behind the scenes you do not see said, you've got to pay back all this money we're giving you with interest, and you've got to cut away all of your social programs. You've got to fire all these people. And we want to privatize everything. We even want your beautiful islands so that we can privatize them and resorts be opened. We want your roads to no longer be free for you to ride on. We want you to have toll booths. We don't want you to be able to pull up to a building, your own building included, without having a parking meter you have to pay for. We don't want water coming out of the tap that you do not pay for now. We want you to pay for it. We want you to pay more for your petrol and more for your food and more for your medicine. So when you look at Spain and Greece and Ireland and Portugal and Slovakia and Malta and all the other countries that are going through austerity pains, and you have to ask, did the people there cause the problem? Were they the primary reason? The answer is no, not in one of them. I'll tell you who the problems are about the central banks. The lawless looting and redistribution of wealth. The central banks, the central bank of all banks, the Bank of International Settlements, warned in 2008 that bailouts of the big banks would create sovereign debt crisis, which would bankrupt nations. Is that not what happened? Yes, it is. The big banks went bust, and so did the debtors. But the government chose to save the big banks instead of the little guys on the main street, thus allowing the banks to continue to try to wring every penny of debt out of debtors. Treasury Secretary Paulson shoved bailouts down Congress's throat by threatening martial law if the bailouts weren't passed, and the bailouts are now perpetual. Moreover, the bailout money is just going to line the pockets of the wealthy instead of helping to stabilize the economy or even the companies receiving the bailouts. Bailout money is being used to subsidize companies run by horrible businessmen, allowing the bankers to receive fat bonuses, to decorate their offices, to buy gold toilets, prostitutes, drugs, and trophy wives for hedge fund managers. A lot of the bailout money is going to the failing company shareholders. Indeed, the leading progressive economists say that the true purpose of the bank's rescue plan is a massive redistribution of wealth to the bank shareholders and their top executives. So Mr. O'Reilly at Fox, you got it exactly opposite. Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, sorry fellas, you got it exactly opposite. It is not Barack Obama and his Congress who are progressives. They couldn't spell progressive. They are as far from progressives as the corporate Democrats are from true liberals. They're as far from progressives as the corporate Republicans are from true conservatives. And if we cannot make those distinctions, we are lost in the fog and obscurity of political manipulation. As a result, it is not Obama wanting to take everyone's possessions and everyone's wealth and redistribute them to the poor. That hasn't even been suggested and wouldn't be done. What has been suggested and what has actually been done is just the opposite. Rescue the banks, distribute massive amounts of wealth to the shareholders and the top executives. The Treasury Department encouraged banks to use the bailout money to buy their competitors and push through an amendment to the tax laws which rewarded mergers in the banking industry. And this has caused a lot of companies to bite off more than they can chew, destabilizing acquiring companies. And as the New York Times notes, quote, tens of billions of bailout dollars have merely passed through AIG to its derivative trading partners. In other words, through a little game playing by the Federal Reserve, taxpayer money is going straight into the pockets of investors of AIG's credit default swaps and is not even really stabilizing AIG. Moreover, a large percentage of the bailouts went to foreign banks, and so did a huge portion of the money from quantitative easing. Indeed, the Fed bailed out Gaddafi's bank in Libya, hedge fund billionaires, equity partnerships, and big companies, but turned its back on the little guy. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm being a little lacking in optimism. Surely the 6 million homes that were foreclosed on, the president by executive order, Congress by ethical mandate, the Federal Reserve by conscious extension, said, wait a second. Is it better for the American economy, for communities, for cities, towns, and rural environments and villages to have you out of your house that can be vandalized, turned into a drug den, a crime haven, devalue the property of your neighbor, and put you homeless on the street where you're no longer able to pay taxes, state, county, city, school, federal, and then have to go on subsidies, food stamps? Is it better to have you do that and couch surf in a friend or family's apartment or home? But is it better then to bring the price of your mortgage down to the actual value of your property and then only charge you 15% in your mortgage payments of your disposable income as a rent so you can stay in your home and have money left in your pocket and still be a stabilizing part of the community where you can be a part of something? No, that's not a good idea. And now when we have a boom in the real estate market, it's not because people are building new homes. It's because banks and business trusts have been buying up millions of homes on the shadow market and from the foreclosure market and then flipping them over as rentals. That is not helping the gross domestic product. That is not relevant to increasing the value in the real estate market. It is just a clever manipulation. In fact, a study of 124 banking crises by the International Monetary Fund found that propping up banks, which are only pretending to be solvent, often leads to austerity. Existing empirical research has shown that providing assistance to banks and their borrowers can be counterproductive, resulting in increased losses to banks, which often abuse forbearance to take unproductive risks at government expense. The typical result of forbearance is a deeper hole in the net worth of banks, crippling tax burdens to finance bank bailouts, and even more severe credit supply contraction and economic decline that would have occurred in the absence of forbearance. Cross-country analysis to date also shows that accommodative policy measures, such as substantial liquidity support, explicit government guarantees on financial institutions' liabilities, and forbearance from prudential regulations tend to be fiscally costly, and that these particular policies do not necessarily accelerate the speed of economic recovery. All too often, central banks privilege stability over cost to the in the heat of the containment phase comes down to this. The banks cannot fail. They have become lawless institutions supported by a lawless justice system. A strong rule of law is essential for a prosperous and stable economy. Yet the government made it official policy not to prosecute fraud, even though main business models adopted by the biggest financial crime in world history, the largest insider trading scandal of all time, the illegal raiding of consumer accounts and blatant financing of drug cartels and terrorists have all gotten away scot-free. No jail time. There are two systems of justice in America, one for the big banks and their fat cats, and for everyone else. While Iceland prosecuted its top criminal bankers and thus quickly got through its financial problems and now has a vibrant economy, the American government has done everything it can to cover up fraud. It is complicit in crimes against humanity. All of the people involved, the White House, both sets of the Congress, the Senate and the House, and of course our Justice Department. They have actively encouraged criminal fraud and attacking those trying to blow the whistle. The rule of law is now as weak in the United States and the United Kingdom as many countries which would be considered rogue nations. This is a sudden change. As famed Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto notes, in a few short decades, the West undercut 150 years of legal reforms and made a global economy possible. Moreover, the U.S. government personnel are now on the take. They have become so corrupt that regulators are literally sleeping with industry prostitutes while they pimp out the American people. The corruption of government officials is staggering, and the system of government-sponsored rating agencies had as its core model bribery. We've gone from a nation of laws to a nation of powerful men making one-sided laws to protect their own interest. In secret, government folks are using laws to crush dissent. It's gotten so bad that even the U.S. Supreme Court justices are saying that we are descending into tyranny. It's not a fiscal cliff, ladies and gentlemen. It's an attempt to rape America, just like Greece and Ireland had been plundered. Washington Blob Global Research. Let us say hello now to Gerald Salante, who is standing by. Nice to have you with us today, Gerald.
Well, thank you. Bravo. That was wonderful. You really summed it up. That was that was more than just a short talk. That was a short book, and you really brought it all together coherently, vividly, and realistically. And beginning what you said, it's devolving into lawlessness, is one of the phrases you use at the beginning of what you said. And that's exactly what's happened in this country. It has devolved into lawlessness. And when you're talking about how the big criminals get no crime time, as we say, the word justice is being misspelled. It's J-U-S-T-U-S, just us. There's no justice for them. And so I applaud you for what you just
thank you.
Wrote and read. It's excellent.
Gerald, I'm going to share just the topic, two topics at a time. And for the remainder of the program, please give us your projections forward, all right, for the next year or two. But let's try to see what might come from the next year. We're going to begin with war. What do you see coming as far as conflict? And also, do you see the bond market being the big bubble that no one's paying attention to? And will it be recognized and will it explode? Those are the two first issues to take on today.
Well, the first one on war. The world is already at war. The first great war of the 21st century has begun. They're just not adding it up. Look what you mentioned what's going on in Europe. There's class warfare in Greece, in Spain, in Portugal, in Ireland, in Italy, in Slovenia, in other places throughout the world. Far too few have much too much, and way too many have much too little. When millions of people take to the streets as frequently as they do, can people see this is, off with their heads 2.0? And then you go over and look what's going on in Yemen. Well, there's a civil war going on. And then in Bahrain, same thing, but don't talk about Bahrain because the U.S. 5th Fleet happens to be stationed there. So the emir over there can't do any wrong. And then you go, of course, there's the civil war in Libya, thanks to that wonderful humanitarian mission launched by our Nobel Peace Prize-winning president. And then, of course, the civil war in Syria, also instigated by the same people that started the Libyan war, for the same reasons. And then you look what's going on in Israel. Israel this week, within I think it's about a week and a half, they announced the building of 5,200 more. They call them settlements, as though this is the prairie and there's nobody out there. These are housing developments. And it's instigating the situation there and inflaming it even more. And then you look at what's going on in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood has taken over, the same thing in Tunisia. And there are civil wars going on in those countries as well, yet they're not calling them that. And by the way, with the prostitutes, the mainstream media never mention, is that both in Tunisia and Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood had absolutely nothing to do with the revolutions that began. And they weren't an Arab Spring. It wasn't a pro-democracy movement. It's about a lot of people in poverty that are being pushed into deeper poverty and are angry about the people at the top of the pyramid raping off all the money. And then you look about what's going on in, when you put it together, whether there's civil wars, regional wars, class warfare, it's war, and it's going to spread. And when you look at, for example, the current events forming future trends, and you read today, for example, and yesterday, about the so-called suicide bombers that are killing more people in Afghanistan. Oh, I forgot to mention the drone strikes going into Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Yemen, and now into the Sudan. When you look at what's going on, how can people not realize that these problems are going to come home to roost? We wrote about this in detail. It's called New Millennium Warfare. In 2000, Gary, I was asked to go to VMI, Virginia Military Institute. That's the same place where Mitt Romney announced his geopolitical platform. And was asked to discuss what New Millennium Warfare would look like. And on the panel afterwards were such people as General Anthony Zinni and others. And I gave the format of what it would look like in the new millennium with New Millennium Warfare. How they say the generals keep fighting the last war. They're still fighting the last war with F-35s that have a price tag of over $1 trillion. Oh, by the way, I forgot. The United States announced last week in an AP report that, oh, we're going to start sending troops into 35 countries across Africa. Isn't that wonderful? And, of course, you know why we're sending them there. Oh, to promote freedom and democracy? No, not according to Peter Pham, the State Department advisor, who's been on the advisory board from AFRICOM, A-F-R-I-C-O-M. Actually, it should be an N at the end. It's a con. And he spelled it out clearly. He said, we're going there, quote, protecting access to hydrocarbons and other strategic resources, which Africa has in abundance, a task which includes ensuring against the vulnerability of those natural riches and ensuring that no other interested third parties, such as China, India, Japan, or Russia, obtain monopolies or preferential treatment. So there you have it.
Okay.
The world war has begun. It's spreading.
Let's go
on
now.
The bond market.
Bond market.
Yeah, the interest rates are going to have to go up at some point. Look what happened in the last few weeks. First, about 8 months ago, we heard from the Brazilian financial minister, Manteiga, said, quote, trade wars have begun by countries such as the United States and the European nations lowering their interest rates to record lows so that they devalue their currency to help exporters export more product. A month ago, the former chairman of the former head of the Bank of England, Mervyn King in New York, said, quote, currency wars have begun. And now Japan just elected a new prime minister, Abe. What has Abe done? He has demanded that the Bank of Japan lower interest rates. Why? Because, and to use his words, a currency war has begun. At some point, interest rates are going to have to go up. When will that happen? Will it happen next year? Maybe not, but possibly. And when they do, the bond market bubble is going to explode as interest rates go higher. You cannot keep this Ponzi scheme alive by just keeping interest rates low, devaluing the dollars and other currencies around the world so their exporters could keep exporting their crap to other countries. Look at the current events that, again, forming future trends. You go back to every report that came out prior to Christmas holiday, and each report said that retail sales were going to increase over 2.5%. The initial data shows it went up 0.7%. So we're not seeing any increase at all. And that is in spite of pumping trillions and trillions of dollars throughout the world, the United States with their QE3s and 4s and whatever else you want to call them. China's dumping in tons of yuan into their system to keep their failing markets afloat. The Europeans are doing it also with their ongoing monetary transactions. I love the language, OMTs. And they said that they would continue to buy up worthless bonds as long as they could continue to do it, which is forever, until it stops, because nothing is indefinite. So what you have is the entire world is propping up their economies by buying worthless bonds and printing worthless money. When will it end? I believe it's going to end not because of a financial crisis. Our best estimate is that it's going to end when we go to war. And war is around the corner as we see it. Because then they will be able to use that excuse to officially devalue the currencies, blame it on terrorists and other people that hate our, quote, freedom and liberty, and put the people deeper into tyranny.
Next issue, what do you see in as far as our further encroachment upon the Bill of Rights, our constitutional liberties, surveillance of Americans, and virtually not a word out of the corporate Democrats, even on MSNBC and on current TV? They're all aligned now. They're not real liberals. They're corporate Democrats. Big difference. Big difference. And tell us what you see as far as continuing the militarization of our police and the overreach of all of our national security apparatus agencies.
As I said, the worse it becomes economically, the more liberties and rights they take away from us. I have a line. I say that conservatives believe and liberals lie. And let me explain. People who call themselves conservative believe stupid things like, you know, we got to kill all the Muslims over there so they don't come over here. I mean, they actually believe that stuff. They believe that invading other countries is proper foreign policy so that we're safe at home. Liberals, on the other hand, lie. I'm so disgusted with Obama apologists. I refuse, when I go to parties anymore, when people start talking to me about trends and asking me questions, I can't stand it anymore. I lay down the line of Obama atrocities, from the raping of the Constitution last year, just about this time, New Year's Eve, with his signing of the National Defense Authorization Act, which allows the military to come and take anybody they want, Obama to kill anybody they want, without any jury, without any charges, without any trial, without any writ of habeas corpus, to take us away, do whatever they want to with us, kill us, and nothing in the way of the Constitution to stop them. And then they'll say to me, and then I'll talk about the warrantless wiretapping and how Obama has outbushed Bush with the Patriot Act, laying out one fact after another. Again, killing American civilians because El Presidente of Los Estados Unidos, the big banana republic that we now have, says so. And they'll say, oh, why do you think he's doing that? What do you mean, why? Why did this kid go nuts up in Connecticut? The why's not important, the is. And then they'll say, well, you know, he's probably getting pressure. Is this guy a man or a mouse? What do you mean he's getting pressure? And they keep making excuses. And that's what's holding back this nation. Not the conservative element, because in fact they're a very small segment of the society. When you look at their numbers, in true evangelical terms, they're a small minority. It's the people that are intellectually equipped to know the truth, but keep lying to themselves because they don't have the courage to believe that the belief system that they believe in is a fraud. And their commander-in-chief is the BSer-in-chief. That's what's holding it back. Are we going to lose more rights? What rights? The more the economy goes down, the more fascism that comes to America.
Okay. Next issue, the fracking future.
We have, in this upcoming Trends Journal that will be out in about 10 days, a 10,000-word report, white paper on fracking, the pros and the cons. I have my own feelings, particularly living in upstate New York and not far from fracking territory. Oh, and by the way, you Obama apologists out there, go back to the debates between the president and Mitt Romney. They were outdoing each other into who would give away more public land to fracking, of which Obama's already opened up 700 million acres. That's right, of public land. Where's it going to go? It's going to continue, unfortunately, unless the people stop it. And again, we have all the pros and cons. Anybody could debate the facts. All the facts are there. As I see it, you know, it's fracking is only going to cause more destruction, whether it's the earthquakes from pumping fracking fluids back into the ground or poisoning the water. However, as you call them, the corporate Democrats in power, fracking is in the future unless the people stop it.
Next up, and this is one that almost never is discussed, there is a major movement back to the land. People leaving California and New York and New Jersey, three of the most, if not the three most, overtaxed and overregulated and highly polluted environments and non-sustainable in many respects. They're going back to more sustainable environments. What do you see the sustainability movement doing and people leaving over-congested and not always hospitable urban environments?
It's going to be a country of the no's and the know-nothings. The no's are going to do everything they can to live a life that has dignity, respect, courage, integrity, and passion. And they're not going to find it in corrupt inner cities or suburbs. And they're going to be, the back to the land movement is going to be huge, particularly as clean, safe food becomes a major, major issue. And also, as we know, unfortunately, what happened in California with the genetically modified foods being stricken down because of the corporate pressure, and the people, actually the people that believed it, is beyond me that they could have voted for it. But also, as we've just seen again, the Obama administration is now allowing genetically modified salmon to also go into the marketplace. So you're going to have a sustainability movement that's also going to have another aspect to it, Gary. We're going to see a growth in the secessionist movements. And it's happening around the world. And it's not a bunch of, you know, right-wing nuts that are pushing this. And everybody has a reason why. And there are, for instance, going on in Spain, in Catalonia, they want to pull away from Spain because they're doing better financially, although they're deep in debt. And they want to stay into the European Union, but yet they want their own independence. The same in Scotland. The same is going on in Italy. You're going to see these movements spreading up around the world, and particularly in the United States. You know, people forgot that after the election, over a million people signed petitions for secessionism. And up in Vermont, far from a white right-wing movement, it was founded by the Second Vermont Republic by Thomas Naylor, who unfortunately, a very dear friend of mine and one of the kindest, real gentlemen I know, passed on recently. He was a professor emeritus at Duke University and a man that truly peace on earth, goodwill to men was his, would be his motto.
Gerald,
he was ahead of that movement.
But that is a show to itself because a lot of people won't understand what you're referring to. I want to keep that separate for a moment, but we are coming up to the end of our regular scheduled program for most of our land-based stations. But I have a lot more questions, including the millennials in motion, that the born around 1980 through 2000, 77 million strong. They're slated to become the first American generation to be financially worse off than their parents are. I need to ask about that and gold and some other things. If people would like to continue listening to this conversation, you can by calling a phone number, 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066, and or go to progressiveradionetwork.com. Because at 55 minutes, we have to say goodbye. So we're saying goodbye to all those stations, but we're continuing on to finish this discussion. Take a moment to explain in lay language exactly what the secessionist movement is, how it has been denigrated by mainly the Democrats and many in the liberals, but what it really represents today.
It means the freedom that we no longer have. And this country, you know, I was one of the first people when the too big to fail big lie became mainstream that this is the merger of state and corporate powers. It's called fascism. And I get these people who say, well, that's not exactly what Mussolini said. No, they're quoting it wrong. That's precisely what Mussolini said. And that's what's happened in this country. This is no different than we should call it the USSA now that it's picked up after the demise of the USSR. Just as the Kremlin couldn't rule that giant country, neither could the Washington Kremlin rule this country. How could we have a gang of 535 senators and congressmen in total telling 312 million people what to do and how to do it? The country is too big to govern. It doesn't work. It's failed at every end. You began this by talking about the fraud of the fiscal cliff. Who could get away with this crap? This has been going on since the summer of 2011, and the incompetence and the inepts have been doing nothing to solve the problems, only making them worse. I will ask you, and I will ask every listener out there, you point to one thing, one, that Washington has done successfully. Oh, the wars, the fake wars that they started in Iraq and Afghanistan, the longest war in history, Afghanistan, in American history. Oh, the wonderful humanitarian mission in Libya, that was a great war too. Oh, health care, God, what a great job they've done. Education. We spend more on education and more on health than any of the OECD nations, and we don't even win place or show in those categories and being near the top. Great job. How about the war on drugs? What a beauty that was. Oh, a couple of trillion dollars spent, and our jails are filled by the correctional industrial complex by dragging people off the street and filling them up for victimless crimes. There's not one thing that Washington has done that they can put their imprimatur on and say, hey, great job. So, what is the secessionist movement about? If you want to live in a state where you have pro-choice, go to that state. If you don't like it, move to a state where you don't have it. If you want to go to a state like Colorado, where they're now going to have it be legal to smoke a joint, go to that state. If you want to stay in the state of perpetual denial of another state, go to that state. Let the people decide their future. That's what secessionism is about. It's breaking up the corrupt union. And by the way, I'm sick of these politicians quoting the Founding Fathers because they only quote what they want. If they want to quote the Founding Fathers, how about this? You should rebel when your nation becomes corrupt, to paraphrase what Jefferson and the others said. So it's a time to rebel. And so the secessionist movement isn't about a bunch of right-wing nuts. It's about a bunch of people who are disgusted with the Washington gang running the show and screwing the people.
How do you reconcile that federal law always usurps state law and local law is usurped by state law? That's one of the problems with fracking. A company comes in, a local community organizes, grassroots support gets out the people. The people say, we're not going to allow you to frack in this area. The company then that is going to frack sues the county and brings in the heavyweight lawyers. The county then has to acquiesce and put it back that they can. And if they drop the lawsuits, and this is being done everywhere in the United States. So at what point do the states regain enough sovereignty to conduct business between other states, but also have the power that if they pass a law, the federal government says, we can pass all the non-smoking, you know, pro-smoking marijuana in your home, privacy if you want, but the federal law is what counts. So if we come knocking in your door, the federal government wins, not the state. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's it. With secessionism, the federal government wouldn't be ruling the state. And you know, you could say the word states' rights, and it has a dirty ring to it because people will associate it with segregation and other issues. But it's more than that. And, you know, there's nothing perfect in this world. But the fact is that federal law is just protecting the federal criminals. And it's a federal takeover. And okay. That's why, again, countries like the former Soviet Union broke up. Look, this is only a blip in history that we're going through. And so there's no reason why this country should be run by Washington anymore. Matter of fact, there's all the reason why it shouldn't be. So the state laws will supersede federal laws.
We have time for one last question, then I'm going to have to invite you back because I've got a lot of fun. You're doing it, such a great job explaining issues. I want you to talk about the millennials in motion, because there's 77 million young people in the United States who are graduating from college, have worked hard, gotten their degrees. They have mountains of debt, compounding interest kicks in, and they're either unemployed or underemployed, living with their parents. What do you see the next year being for them?
Well, as we call them, Generation F'd. You know, this generation is the only generation in modern American history that believes that their future will be bleaker than the past. And they should, because they don't have a shot at it. 50% of them that have jobs that require high school education. This is going to be the group, by the way, that could really lead a positive change in America. And this is the one we're putting our money on, because they are well-educated. They do understand what's going on. And if they could become free in their minds and put their energies in the right direction, this could be, the millennial generation could be the saving generation of this country. Because they're smart enough to know that they have no future here. And guess what? They're not alone. You look at the unemployment rates among people between the ages of 18 to 28 around the world, and you were talking about Europe before, you're looking at over 50% in Spain, 50% in Greece. It's about 20% in Italy, 25% in Portugal, and in the United States officially around 14%. So this group has a lot of great potential to really push an awakening, a new direction in this country, because they're not going to have a shot at it. They're not going to be able to go into the workforce and use the skills that they've gotten from college, and they're not going to get out of that mountain of debt. And by the way, that's also going to put downward pressure on the real estate market, because they're not going to be able to buy homes. They're going to spend most of their lives as indentured servants paying off debt, unless the course has changed.
Gerald, we have to have a continuation. I haven't gotten through all the issues. I'm inviting you back in the next few days. Whenever you have a moment, please let us know. We want to continue, all right?
Oh, I'd love to. Thanks so much, Gary.
Gerald Celante. He is here to share his insights into the new year, and he is the publisher of The Trends Journal, thetrendsjournal.com. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. We appreciate your support. Let's now say hello to our next host here on the Progressive Radio Network, Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we'll be spending some time with Yanis Varoufakis, who is a Greek economist, and he says that there is an illusion about the debt crisis. It really isn't about debt. It is, in fact, quite the opposite. Too much money with no place to go.
Well, I just dealt with that, except I found a place for it to go. Wall Street, hedge funds, corporate. And I'm sure that half the hedge fund wives are sticking it up their ass and saving it for their divorce so they can marry their plastic surgeon after 73 different implants. Have a good show, Utrice.
Oh, God.
Cowboys, the wrestlers, the tumblers, the clowns, the roustabouts that move the show at dawn. The music, the spotlights, the people, the towns, your baggage with the labels pasted on.
The sawdust and the horses and the smell. The towel you've taken from the last hotel.
There's no business like show, business like no, business like no.
Everything about it is appealing.
Everything the traffic will allow.